Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Richard, how are you? Welcome to the podcast.
I'm very well. Thank you for having me. Hope you're doing well also.
Yeah, no, thank you. For those that don't know, you're up in Canada.
Right? I am. I'm in Toronto. I'm actually in Vaughan, which is about 40 kilometers north of Toronto, but yeah.
Yeah, so I thought it'd be interesting. You're PhD, right?
I am. Yeah.
And what's your specialty? What's your major
in? Well, yeah, basically sports science would be the most broad way to define it. I was a soccer player and then became a coach and got into, you know, I studied kinesiology, and so actually my research was done in the sport, both looking into the effectiveness of different types of training to improve fitness for soccer players. And then eventually I also, I did a lot of work with performance analysis, so heart rate and GPS analysis of games at both the college level and then also in the professional level in Canada in our new Canadian Premier League. So,
yeah, I started following you maybe a month or so ago on X, and you and I kind of connected, and I can't remember what the post was, but we kind of interacted a little bit. And then I started following some of your content, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. It was quite clear that you have played the game, which there's not that many sports scientists that I've come across that play the game, that actually understand the differences between the demands that soccer requires versus other sports. So I thought this would be fun to have you on, and maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the current trends. Technology is always one of those things where, look, I'm old school, and anybody that knows me, you know, I'm a 63-year-old guy. I started playing in the 70s and started coaching in the 90s. And there wasn't a lot of technology out there, and we all figured out a way to improve players and help them get better without the technology. So some of us old school guys are trying to figure out what is going on with the world of technology. But yet I've used GPS units with players to some success. I think it helps players understand at least where they're coming from, and I think that coaches that use it properly can find some real value. Where is the world of technology going in soccer? What direction are we headed? Is AI coming into play and being used now, and in what way? So what can we expect out of technology in soccer as far as fitness and analysis goes?
So that's a great question.
And that's a big question. I know.
Yeah,
there's
no, and I actually, even in your intro there, sorry, I'm in my office, so the phone is ringing, but I'll keep it going. When you explain, you know, you're a little more old school, you obviously you started coaching and all that maybe before a lot of the technology existed. So I actually think that there's going to be a bit of a return more to that style of coaching, and not ignoring or like not using sports science, but maybe sifting through the noise somewhat and not over relying on technology on the one hand. And then on the other hand, and I know you mentioned AI, so what I would say is I've spent a lot of my work more or less looking at the real physical variables. I mentioned heart rate, GPS, and so we can quantify physically very clearly what's going on with athletes, but the sport is not a physical competition. It's a, you know, it's a game that requires physical ability, but it's really about players interacting with their teammates. You know, it's a team game. And so what I think is interesting, and some of my colleagues are actually doing research in this area, and they are using AI and computer modeling and everything is, but there are ways that now, by looking at video of games, there are ways that you can start to quantify what's happening at the team level first because of the interactions of small groups of players, the back four, the back four plus two midfielders, whatever. And eventually you can even, there are, again, colleagues of mine that are building computer models to analyze the performance of the whole team. And in fact, they're even able to they're calling the variable momentum, but they're able to, by using video analysis and by looking at what's happening between players, the passing interactions, the movement off the ball, all of that, and how they respond to the opponent, they're able to start to measure momentum in a game and even start to sort of predict how the momentum is going to change in the game. And the interesting thing about that variable is that, the more momentum your team has, well, the more likely it is that you're going to get scoring opportunities, corner kicks, in fact, even score more goals and win more games. So I think that the next level with technology is going to be really trying to go beyond just how much running or heart rate or those sort of physical variables and looking into the interaction of the team. And at the same time, and when you're speaking, it reminds me of this great quote from Pep Guardiola, where he says that his favorite instrument is the eyometer, meaning his eyes. Yeah. So I think that there's going to be this almost this conflict maybe between, there's a lot of things that coaches just have to look for, and you can't exactly measure. If you're a good coach, you're an experienced coach, you're able to kind of pick out what's going on, instruct your players accordingly, solve problems, make changes, all of that from what you see. And then the use of technology, I think, is going to go to the really higher level, as I said, performance analysis with video. That's what I think. And AI is going to help with that. So, yeah.
No, I think you're right. And if
Yeah.
I'm, it's hard when you've been around the game as long as I have to remember how hard it was when I first started coaching. And I thought I knew the game okay, but I was smart enough to know that I needed to go to coaching school. I needed to be taught. I needed to find mentors. I needed to learn. And I think sometimes coaches like me that have been around a while forget that for younger coaches. And I think what worries me just a little bit about technology is if we have all of these tools for young coaches that they learn to rely on those tools and not study the game. And that worries me a little bit. So I think for younger coaches out there that might be listening, I'm going to encourage you, find mentors, find older coaches that know the game, talk to them about the game and study the game with not without the technology, but alongside the use of technology. Technology will never tell us everything that we need to know about this game because it is so infused with the personalities of the individual players, and it is, we often hear it compared to chess. Yes, it's like chess, except when you're playing chess, yes, there's a lot of pieces, but there's one brain on each side moving the pieces. In soccer, you've got these 11 pieces plus your 11 opponents, and you've got 22 brains plus the coaches, plus the officials' personalities, plus the influence of the fans and the emotions, and you've got all of these different minds interacting at the same time, which makes it an infinite combination of more complication to what the game is and to what it creates. And I know one of our both people that we follow is Todd Bean. He's of course, the Cruyffian school. Who I think is one of the greatest minds that ever lived in our sport. And you know, that's Cruyff's son-in-law, and he teaches in the Cruyffian methodology. And you know, he talks a lot about this, that it's not just about technique, or it's not just about the physical, but it's mostly a mental game, you know, and being able to, as you said earlier, be a predictor of what's going to happen next. He often tells a story about Johan Cruyff being able to watch a game, and I can't remember what the number was, but he could predict with a high degree of certainty 8 to 10 moves ahead of what was actually had happened yet. And Todd says, I got lucky at one point, you know, that I could predict 3 moves ahead. And Cruyff could predict 8 to 11 moves ahead, or 8 to 10. I can't remember exactly what the number was, but it's pretty crazy. And he says, it, you watch it happen, and you could see it happening, and it's just a different way of thinking, right? And this is what I was talking about AI maybe coming into play in the future, for analysis of predictability, right? Being able to analyze through a series of patterns, you know, how a game against, you know, an upcoming opponent might play out. And I'm curious about that side of it. Yeah. What have you heard, or have you experimented with, or are we there yet, or are we not there yet? What do you think about that?
So yeah, I would say you're very correct in the sense that the machine learning is a really interesting technology because basically computer models become better and if the model is built to predict an outcome or a series of outcomes or whatever, the models become better the more data that they get. And so and when I say better, they become more accurate. So with stronger and more accurate predictive modeling and with the accumulation of more data, well, eventually, there are tools, there are software programs and whatever that you can upload video of games and you can start to look at this data, but they're going to start to become more accurate at predicting. What I think though is ultimately because the computers aren't playing the games, the
Right.
computers are taking data so the key for coaching, and I'm going away from like so there's sort of like the sports science and then there's the coaching side of it, and often even as a sports scientist, my biggest role, like I'm happy you caught on, I don't think that sports scientists working in soccer should not be soccer people. They should have played at some level. They should even, in fact, I'm a big advocate that fitness coaches take all the coaching courses and learn how to coach as well, because I don't believe you can really influence a coach or a team as a sports scientist if you don't really understand the sport. But the key is, as sports scientists, our job is to kind of translate data and figure out how to use it. And so sports scientists, fitness coaches, and coaches are going to end up using the data that you get from predictive modeling to try to be a little bit more efficient in the way that we instruct our players. So it's a little bit different than telling them, hey, the last 3 times you got the ball there, whatever, you had a different opportunity. Now I've got some numbers to show you, right? And I'm going to say, well, it's not just me
Right.
that's suggesting that this might have been a better option. Have a look at this. So I think it's technology is a tool, and in the right hands you can use it, and you I think it probably can make coaches a little more efficient and maybe players more efficient in the long run. And but if you don't understand it properly, if you don't interpret the data properly, it might even do
Right.
more harm than good. I'm also kind of interested in I don't know if it's just me becoming a little, because I'm getting older now too, and maybe I'm getting a little grumpy, but I'm not seeing the same level of like creativity and in the big games and in the international tournaments and that I would have seen maybe in the late 90s or the 2000s. I feel like a lot of I don't know, a lot of the club teams tend to be playing the same way. The national teams are They're kind of all like
That's
I'm
interesting that you
yeah, I don't know.
said that. I just reshared a post that some a photo a video that somebody had had posted of the 74 World Cup and some of the clips of Cruyff playing. And it's interesting when you see the style. It was a rougher game, you know. The players could definitely be more physical and not be thrown out of games, and some of the tackles could be harder. Now that's certainly true, and I don't know. The creativity, as you said, I feel like, you know, are we going to get another Bergkamp? You know, are we going to get another Cruyff? Right? Are we going to get another, you know, a George
Ronaldinho?
Best? Right? Are those types of players being created today, or are we coaching it out of them? Right? Are we teaching them? You know, I hear people talk about, hey, this is a team sport. Yeah, it's an unusual sport because it's a team sport, yet it's an individual sport. And for those that maybe don't know, maybe parents listening to this that know American football better than soccer, I mean, you're not going to discourage a running back from grabbing the ball and beating multiple players and taking it into the goal. Could they lateral it? Could they give it to another player at a certain moment? Yeah, they could share it. They could do that. But if an individual player can take on multiple players and be successful, you know, we shouldn't discourage that individual creativity and that individual recognition of 1v1s and a little space in behind. And if I beat this player, I can take another 10 yards and I can draw other players towards me and that'll open up other players. I mean, that individual creativity, I think at moments in the modern game might be being coached out of players. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree, and I am concerned that the more we start to use technology, the more we start to look at like predictive modeling. I mean, the truth is, especially at the highest level, unless your team already has a really special player that's capable of dribbling, getting past few players, and really unbalancing the defense, most and a lot of teams don't have that. Then for sure there's a certain way to play that's going to maximize the likelihood that you're going to win. And then if that
100%.
mentality trickles down to the youth game, and well, at some point then those players that have the potential to become those really special players, they don't develop, or they're stifled or whatever. And I mean, I guess the antidote to that, though, like I think, has to then come at the youth level, and has to come with giving players a little bit of freedom. And I mean, I just, again, as you're speaking, I'm remembering the little run that Messi made against Croatia in the last World Cup, when he kind of just got the ball past the half line and just dribbled, and nobody could stop him. He went one way, he went the other way, he ended up making a real short pass along the goal line. And like that type of special player who can do those things, they do win games. And when a defense is really well organized, then the best way to break that organized defense down is with a special player. But we need to develop those players. So
Right.
I like technology, I like all of it, but I don't ever want to see it get in the way of player development. So
Yeah, no, I agree, and I do worry about that. We'll see what this World Cup brings, but we all kind of know who the players are on the world stage right now that have those abilities to create something, you know, and unfortunately, you know, we've got you know Ronaldo, and these guys are getting older now, so some of the younger players have to step up. And you know, who's going to be have you been paying attention? Who do you think's going to be the you have any dark horses for breakout stars of this coming World Cup?
A great question. I mean, I think, I don't know if I can call him a dark horse because he's already a star, but I feel like Yamal is set to be a star in this tournament.
Yeah, this could be the World Cup that really puts him on the world stage. Yeah, I agree.
I like him. I don't know. I'm trying to be biased here with our own Canadian team, but we've got some talent here. Some of them
They
that
have
have
to
been in
win
the
first. I mean, it's the
I
same
know,
problem with the United States, right? I mean, you've got
yeah.
to get out of you got to get out of the second round. I mean, you know, if you make it out of the first round and then get knocked out right away, nobody cares.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And
So
that's the
I,
same problem the US will have.
yeah, they will too. And I think that it's like Canada now, I'm watching the US team as well, and I think Canada now has a bit of a special group, better, in my opinion, better than the States right now. But I think Canada and the US have a similar problem overall with the ability to develop talent. And I mean, we can talk more about that if you
Yeah,
like,
do
but
you think because we have f fairly similar systems, right? We have singular league run sort of league owned pro systems. We don't have a club system like they have in Europe, where we have each town, virtually every small town has their own club. They can work their way up into the first division. You know, we don't have that in either country, and we both have systems. Us with MLS Next on the men's side, and with ECNL on the women's side, where it's single league dominant. So it feels like it's, you know, not government controlled in the sense of U.S. government or Canadian federal government, but government
Sure.
insofar as the league government. Controlled systems, poorer players are being knocked out of the systems by virtue of not having money. And I don't want to hear the argument, yeah, but if they're good enough, somebody will pay their scholarship. You know, you can't scholarship every poor player, so you're definitely leaving poorer players out of the system, you know. And how do those players even get discovered? And you've got the same problem that the United States has in that the land mass of Canada is like the land mass of the United States. It's not like England, where you can be in, you know, or France, where you can cover the north to the south in one day.
In a
You
day,
know, our countries
in a train.
don't allow that. So you know you're missing players, right?
Well, I guess I would sum it up this way, that I think that the two sort of ingredients almost that you would need to try to optimize player development. Because again, as I said, Canada, even with our system the way it is, we have a relatively special group that, that is probably the best national team we've ever had right now. But the two ingredients, the first is that at the youth level, I know you've touched on it, and I'll just be clear that big cities need to have multiple professional clubs in the city, because if they have multiple professional clubs with academies, then those academies, they compete for players. And so with the MLS model, and obviously we have our teams in MLS, and then we have our own league, which is very small, right? Only 8 teams in our league. Okay, every big city, there's one club. And so that one club at the academy level, like there's no competition for that academy. And the lack of competition, it means that there's no incentive. So it
Right.
doesn't mean all the coaches are bad and all, like there's fine. There's some good coaches in there, and there's some people that are capable or whatever, but I mean, I've seen it. I worked in Uruguay for a year in South America. I've traveled all over the world. I worked with the national team here, so I've seen what it's like, and everywhere else. And you just can't replicate that level of competition between academies. If one doesn't do a good job with scouting, if one doesn't have a good, goalkeeper coach or whatever, they lose out
Yeah.
immediately, right? And so, now that being said, okay. The second ingredient, outside of the fact that you need these incentives to develop and all that, is the senior teams need incentives to win. And so we don't have, I know I'm not, I'm, this is not my, I'm not the first one to come up with this or whatever, but without promotion and relegation, yes, there's playoffs. Yes, there's and even in Canada we have our Canadian Championship, and so there's some upsets that happen sometimes. There's even amateur clubs that beat pro clubs, and they get on to go on to the CONCACAF Champions League if they do well. Our pro clubs, we have even our CPL clubs that have gone there. So there are some incentives to win, but there's not that real push to get promoted. And of course, there's no push to get relegated. And I can give you just a personal example, which is 4 years ago, I was the director of sports science with the Halifax Wanderers in the Canadian Premier League. And we actually had a decent start to our season, but by the beginning of August, now you've got August, September, October, or end of October is the season. It's 3 months. So by the beginning of August, because we had had a string of losses, we knew that we weren't going to make the playoffs by that time. And so you've got, a dozen or more games. There's no motivation. There's no incentive to train hard every day to get ready for those games when you know that that the games are basically meaningless.
Right.
And there's just too much of that across the entire MLS, across the entire
Right.
CPL. Now you have, okay,
Right.
the season is shorter. As I said, with the national team, we saw this very clearly. Our biggest competition in CONCACAF is Mexico, other than the United States, and the
Right.
Mexicans have a much longer league, and it's like a European league. There's promotion, relegation. They have those things. They have the academies are incentivized to develop, the senior teams are incentivized to win. We cannot produce players out of our environment that are capable of going up against guys that came out of that environment. And it's I don't know, like to change that would be tough now because MLS is so entrenched and it's a franchise model, and certainly they're not going to accept any changes. So yeah,
No.
it's a big challenge.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. And I don't know that. Well, there's not an immediate answer. And look, I understand why MLS did what they did when, because I was, I remember NASL days, North American Soccer League, and you'd watch New York, buy Pele and buy Beckenbauer, and you get these players and then dominate, and other clubs wouldn't be able to compete, and then pretty soon, those clubs were out of business, and then you bring in some other clubs, and then they'd be out of business, and eventually the whole league failed. And when they created MLS, they created it with the franchise model because the league wanted to be able to control the costs, right? And they wanted to be able to control salaries and control the costs to keep it in business. And frankly, it worked. It worked. Look how long MLS has been around now. It's the longest league that the United States has ever, and then the Canadian clubs that are involved in it. It's the longest it's ever been around. However, it's the downside is all of the things that we've been talking about. Without the idea of promotion and relegation, it's very difficult to have those incentives for the lower clubs or for ownership of other teams, like we're seeing investments in NPSL or USL. Boy, how many years are you willing to lose millions of dollars with no hope of ever being promoted into the top league? So it's not a matter of if you're going to lose millions, it's how many years are you willing to lose millions, because it's
Right,
going to
yeah.
happen. You're going to lose money.
Yeah,
And
and the truth is our Canadian Premier League, it's the same situation with those clubs. I mean, they just it, on some levels I've called it a chicken and egg problem as well, because there are lots of soccer fans in Canada, as there are obviously in the States, lots, right? But like it's just not that easy to get soccer fans interested, to pay money, interested enough to pay money to watch
right.
the CPL game. So the clubs, they don't really have any revenue. They're not selling a lot of tickets. The games are on an online streaming service, which is relatively cheap. So it's not like they have a big TV deal. So with no revenue, and you still have to pay your players, coaches, everything, full-time salaries, not a lot of money, but enough. It's still,
Right.
yeah, they are. I mean, they're, I don't know the exact numbers, but I've done the math and I'm sure they're losing $1 million, maybe more, every year, and they have to sustain it, so
Yeah.
it's difficult.
All right. Enough griping from two guys that
Yeah,
have no
right,
answers.
right, yeah.
So one of the top things I wanted to talk about, the college season's going to be getting underway in 6 weeks or so. The women will start reporting August 1st. And one of the first things that coaches will do is fitness testing, right?
Yeah.
So they'll come in, and it's one of the players, it's always their biggest fear is fitness testing. They dread the first week or two. You know, coaches quite often the pattern will be double days. We'll get together in the morning and we'll kill you, and then in the afternoon we'll do fitness testing, or vice versa, you know. I know certainly towards the end of my career I completely changed, and I did a little bit of fitness testing with the guys and the girls. I almost completely eliminated it, because I just it was wasn't finding value in it. I think if you've got a big staff and you've got a nice big support staff, there can be some value of establishing baselines so that when players get injured, you know what their fittest was, and you can see when they're coming back from injury. Can they meet those, at least those baselines, so you know if they're ready to play coming off of injury or not? I think there's some value there. I think there's some value to seeing if, you know, if you're pushing players too hard, are their numbers dropping off? So I think if you're, you know, repeating those tests at certain times of the year, there's probably some value there. But overall, I think most college coaches, they come in, they do a fitness test, they do it at the beginning of the year. If the players pass, great. If they don't, they punish them and don't allow them to participate. Some coaches won't allow them to participate until they pass the fitness tests, and then that's it. Then they never hear about those fitness tests for the next 10 months. And so what are your thoughts on fitness testing and the proper way to use fitness testing, and what coaches should be doing with that data and how they can use it? And let's assume we're talking about a staff of, you know, three, because that's probably the average in the United States.
Head coach, assistant coach, and maybe a fitness coach or
And maybe
someone
a
else. Yeah.
part-time
Okay.
assistant. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So, first of all, yeah, I think what you've said, it's a very accurate description of what happens. I would start by saying, this is actually like a little speech almost that I give to players before I test them. And I know for sure I've done over 20,000 yo-yo tests in my career. In fact, my PhD thesis was an investigation of that test, so I've done a lot with it. So what I tell them is that the testing is like looking in a mirror, the same way when you actually look in a mirror, it's simply a reflection of how prepared you are. So if you know, I use an analogy that, like, if you imagine you didn't sleep at all, you just rolled all out of bed, didn't touch your hair, nothing, and you looked in the mirror, it might not look very good because you're not prepared. But on the other hand, if you got 9 hours of sleep, shower, ate breakfast, have a coffee, fix, and then you look better. So that's the reflection. Now, that's the reflection of your preparedness. The test is simply a reflection of your physical preparedness. And so, of course, it makes sense that coaches, they're getting ready for their season. And in preseason, they want to see which players are prepared and which aren't. And a lot of times, the college season, as far as I know in the States, I mean, you have your fall season. Like, they're not training, or they may be training in the summer, but basically you're starting in, late August, and you go till, the end of the winter kind of thing. And so the idea is that if they're coming in for preseason in August, the test allows you to determine who has done a good job preparing and who has not. I guess I don't think, like, you don't have to set, a standard and then, like, cut everyone that doesn't make it. But I would also say that if players are coming in unprepared, well, let's use a school analogy. If you take a math test and there's a certain standard, and some of the players fail the standard or whatever, or some of the students, let's say, fail the standard, well, they might be assigned extra homework. They might be told, okay, you're gonna do everything that the class is doing, but you're also gonna have to do this extra half hour, hour a day, whatever. And so the way that works in soccer is that maybe there's some players now that, within reason, can do a little bit of extra conditioning to try to get themselves up to, like, whatever the standard is. And you said it, one of the reasons why fitness tests are so important is because you don't just want to know, like, in general, is a player prepared? they should be prepared for the demands, because if not, then the risk of injury goes up. And you still have this issue with you don't necessarily have unlimited substitutions and all that. So you want to know, can you get out of them what you need to win, and can they be healthy and stay healthy? So I like testing. I think the key is that the college coaches, we saw a big shift in Canada around the late 2000s, 08, 09, when all of a sudden coaching in college became full time. They started to, even now we have some scholarships. We're nowhere near where you guys are with that, but it became a lot more professionalized. I played in university 1999 to 2004, and we didn't see our coach until August, and then when the season ended in November, we didn't see him again until August.
Right.
So we were on our own. Now, the most successful college and university teams in Canada, they don't play as, York University or whatever in the summer, but all the players are in a club team together. And in fact, usually it's the coach and the assistant coach of the university team that coaches them all summer. So now, they're training together. They can have a strength and conditioning program that they do and all of that. And so then when you bring them in August for preseason, you have a good idea of what they should have been doing and how fit they should be. And I think, the testing is a good way to hold them accountable to that. But I just wouldn't look at, like, if they need extra conditioning as punishment so much as I look at it as it's what you need to get up to the standard. And then I think the big thing, because you touched on it too when you said, that there was 2-a-day training and all of that, periodization is very important.
Right.
And coaches understanding, this has been a big passion of mine. I have courses that I teach about this, both at the university level, but also I teach coaches about this because I think in Canada and the United States, we don't do a good job of teaching sports science to coaches, and because coaches are the ones that plan everything. It's never going to do you any good to run players into the ground, and especially not if those players are unfit. So
Right.
coaches need a good system to quantify the training load, and then they need to really understand how to make these small incremental increases. I've done it at the Canadian university level for many years, and when if you can build in a periodization model properly, you can even take players that weren't fit in August, and by the time the playoffs come around at Halloween time or whatever, that they can be prepared and they can stay healthy. But you can't do that by running them into the ground in preseason means that the load that you do today is way too much higher than what they're capable of. And
Right.
that's where, you get like sickness and injury. And so I think a good understanding of periodization would probably solve almost all of this. But I do like using fitness tests. Sorry, it's a long-winded answer, but I,
No, that's okay because I look, there's going to be people that are listening right now that have no idea what you're talking about when you say periodization. It's just a big word and they don't know what it means. Can you give us a Reader's Digest, a concise version of what
Absolutely.
periodization is, because it's big
Absolutely.
and it depends on a lot of different things. Periodization for a pro team in Europe with a 10-month season is different than the 10-week season that a
College.
college team has. But
Right.
describe for us what you mean by periodization.
Got it. So basically, you have this concept of training load, and training load is the product of volume and intensity. Volume is how much training, intensity is how hard. Okay. And in fact, you can literally, if you have a number for volume, like a number of minutes as an example, and then a number for intensity, I like to teach it by literally, you can use a scale from 0 to 10. 0 is rest, 10 is maximal. And you can ask the players after every training session how hard their training was from 0 to 10. If they say 6, it's 60%, whatever. Now you have a number for intensity, you have a number for volume, and you can multiply those numbers, and then you get training load. So if you calculate training load over about 3 weeks and you get an average, that's a nice number, 3 weeks, maybe a month or so, okay? That average training load that the players have experienced, that is representative of their capacity right now. It's the average over the last 3 weeks. And then there's, you can go moving averages, you can do all kinds of things to make it more accurate. But just think of your current fitness level is literally the average of the workouts you've been doing over the last 3 weeks. Okay? So periodization simply implies once you've calculated, training load over 3 weeks or more, periodization implies that then in your training today or the next one you're planning for, that you make some small incremental increases relative to the average. And really the way to do that is to go as little as 1 or 2% higher. And the upper limit is never more than 20%. And usually, 10 to 15% is kind of a good standard. And then if you do that, well, now all of a sudden, now you've made a jump.
You've
Now
raised
you've
that
got to kind of,
baseline, right?
yeah, now you got to keep it there for a little while. You don't raise every day, because if you did raise every day, then very soon you'd be too high.
Right.
There's even, I hope that made sense, because there's a statistic, it's called the acute to chronic load ratio, or acute to chronic workload ratio, ACWR. And it's the ratio between chronic workload, that's what I explained, the average, and acute workload, that's what you did today. And in fact, and this has been research, I've done some research on it, it's very well studied. If you make the acute to chronic load ratio greater than 1.2, in simple terms, that means if you do today something that is 20% or more greater than what you've been doing, your risk of injury goes way up. So if you keep the acute to chronic load ratio greater than one, that means it's a little harder than what it was before, but less than 1.2, now you're in that area where you can have overload, because without overload, your fitness doesn't improve. So you need some level of overload, but if you keep it below 1.2, or below 20% higher than the average, that's kind of the sweet spot for minimizing the risk of injury. Periodization is about planning training load over periods of time. That's why it's called periodization, okay? In order to make those small increases so that you can improve, fitness and everything else, while minimizing the risk of injury. And that's the concept that I, that's what I teach in my coaching courses. And I think that's a concept that honestly is lost in the North American, not Mexico, but Canada, United States, coach education. They don't get nearly enough of that information. I was a
Oh,
coach
100%
educator.
agree. I've gone all the way through my A license, and the amount of time spent on this topic is almost zero. Not quite, but it's almost zero. Yes.
And I know, because I taught it in Canada, and we would get an hour and a half on one afternoon out of a 14-day licensing course or whatever.
Crazy.
There was no exam, there was no theory, that it was,
Right.
and the irony was that then, the coaches that, got their B license and A license, and good coaches, whatever, but these would be the ones that they would become technical director of a big club, and now they're implementing a curriculum. In fact, what they're doing is they're teaching their coaches about periodization, but they don't have the knowledge. Or, a lot of the A license coaches, they're the ones that become the head coach at a university. And again, they're, so everyone that's like responsible for planning training really needs to understand this stuff. And I would argue almost none of them do. And I think that, rather than just the emphasis on fitness testing, I think it's the lack of knowledge about training load in the college game that is a much bigger problem. Because if they did understand, they would put the testing results into perspective, and they would, I mean, 2 or 3 practices a day, honestly, that doesn't work unless you've been building up that capacity all summer. All you do is you make it much more likely that the players are going to get hurt.
No,
So,
100%. And we are seeing here in the United States, at least, an ACL epidemic. It's really bad on the women's side. But the crazy part for me is I can't recall in all of my 30 plus years of coaching on the men's side ever having an ACL tear. And we're starting to see them on the men's side now. And we've got this really crazy schedule that is not helping players at all. So, on the youth side, we'll go play once a week, Oh, let's do a tournament this weekend. Let's play 3 to 5 games in a weekend. And then we'll go a month where we maybe play once a week. And then we'll throw them into 3 games in 3 days. And then we'll go. So we're yo-yoing up and down this schedule. And then when they get into college, it's same thing. We'll play 2 games a week, and one day a week, we will train at a very high level intensity. So 3 days a week, we're throwing them to very high level intensity, and the other 3 to 3 days a week, we're going at a very low intensity. And so you get this yo-yoing effect instead of this steady building that you were talking about. We get this yo-yoing effect of very intense, crazy, unrealistic intensity. I mean, 3 games in 3 days is it's super bizarre. In anywhere else in the world, nobody does that. I mean, heck, if a Premier League team has to play 3 games in 8 or 9 days,
10
the
days,
coaches are complaining because they know it's not realistic to expect their players to do this.
sorry, I almost interrupted you there just because I wanted to make a note of what you've described is a violation of the acute to chronic load ratio, right? It means, this once a week or whatever it is, and then going to, two, three games in over a weekend. Well, that increase in load is too much. And so I think there is this funny thing because I'm also quite critical of the other side of the argument where everyone is like afraid to train too much or afraid. Like, I think, if we look at the way that athletes develop, and sometimes even in other sports, we can see lots of examples. I don't think that the right way to look at training is that there's like too much and or there's like not enough. The problem is not too much. The problem is too much too soon. And not building up a capacity to be able to do more. Now, there's an upper limit, as you said, multiple games back to back. I mean, in fact, I remember over 10 years ago now, I wrote an article, which basically the title of the article was "How Canadian College and University Soccer is Hurting Canadian Players," because I did an analysis. Now, the Canadian season was every single weekend, a game on Saturday and a game on Sunday. They never even did a weekday, like a Wednesday game, and like never. And then they would build up to the provincial championship, which was quarterfinal on Thursday, semifinal on Saturday, final on Sunday. And then if you won, you go to the national championship, which had the exact same. So if you went for 8 weeks or something, there was like 24 games. I mean, it was unbelievable. Like the back-to-back games and all that, I mean, that's never good. There's almost nothing you can do to prepare yourself for that. And in fact, what I said in the article, and I made this point because I lived it. Like I played in university, so the only thing that saves players in those environments is that the team they're playing is in the same, they're just as tired. So you're suffering together rather than worrying about because if yeah if you had to play a team that was fresh you'd never make it but going away from those extremes, the biggest problem, and again you touched on it because you see it every time there's a jump up in level. So a high school or teenagers, whatever, they're in their club, maybe they train 3 or 4 days a week, maybe, right? Usually the intensity, the overall load is not that high, okay? And then they go to college, it's every day and sometimes twice a day. There's nothing wrong with training every day. All professional players train every day. There's nothing wrong with lifting weights in the morning and training like that's the way you do it. But you have to build up to that capacity. The problem is not the model at the high level. The problem is the jump. The jump is a violation of the acute to chronic load ratio. And so this is where I go back to, okay, well, how do you get players to have an appropriate training load? The coaches need to understand training load. And then they can start to build in, not don't be afraid to push them here there. The rise in ACL injuries is very interesting to me. I think if we're going to put the female athletes aside, because there's some issues there with anatomy and that you honestly can't really get away from, but you mentioned, and you're absolutely right, that there has been even an increase in men and boys, tearing their ACLs. Turf is playing a factor, okay? But I
I
also
think so
think,
too. I definitely think so too because it doesn't give way. It's obvious, I think. Grass, when you make a mistake, the turf can it'll tear away from you and it'll allow you to fall where turf does not do
There's
that.
a smaller coefficient of friction. Okay. Now, on top of that, I think that there is an issue with undertraining at the youth level, and again, those bigger jumps. Athletes when they're younger, and I won't even call them soccer players. I'm just going to say athletes because they should be ideally doing more than just soccer, but they need to accumulate a lot of volume of training when they're kids. And in fact, I think it's a worthwhile protocol to, especially before puberty, to almost turn the model that we have upside down. We're very, like in Canada anyway, we're almost scared to have any program for sports or whatever that has more than 1 or 2 days a week until after puberty. After puberty is where we, but if you look at the way children are, how much flexibility they have, their capacity to exercise, and you know this if you around kids, you can see that they can run around all day. If 8, 9, 10 years old,
No, it always cracks me up, Richard, not to interrupt, but it always cracks me up when people talk about, you need to take an 8 or 10 year old and you need to warm them up. Are you kidding? Walk into a classroom. Ask them to go outside and sprint to the fence, sprint back. You won't have a single muscle tear
They
ever
could do a
out of
somersault. They
50,
can
50,000 kids. Not one injury. They're so flexible. They don't really have the same requirements that post-puberty, and adults do. Not different bodies.
So I think and this would have to be like almost a change in culture. I think I've even in my business, we've started now to work with more than just athletes and more than just soccer. I think phys ed class needs to be much more demanding. I think kids need much more exercise. They need to,
Yes.
and also I'm always a little bit irritated about this talk of specialization because it's almost as though we say, well, early specialization is bad, and then, parents and coaches interpret that as, well, we shouldn't be playing soccer more than 2 or 3 days a week because then it's bad. No, you could play soccer every day, but you could also play tennis and join the cross country team at school. And again, as I said, get 3 or 4 hours of exercise every day. You can build up to it, but there's nothing wrong with kids doing that. Soccer can be their primary sport and they can play it a lot. Because I would say without playing it for many hours a day, I don't know how you're going to develop any technique. I mean, I wasn't even a good player and I played every day. So, you can only imagine how many hours did Messi spend every day? Was he worried about overtraining, do you think, when he was,
Yeah,
11 years old or no?
no.
Like, so it's like we take this slogan, which is early specialization is bad, and then we misapply it. And now everyone's afraid to exercise. And then, as you pointed out, at some point they jump from their club to the college level, or they get into a youth national team camp or something. They're not ready. They're not prepared for it. And so, even putting aside the sex differences, putting aside the turf, which are obviously factors, it comes back to training load. Before puberty, I think kids should be exercising many, many hours a day. And the more we break away from that, I'm convinced that we're going to see more and more injuries. Maybe one day I can even get in, with my university and we can start to study. It's hard to study, because there's many variables there, but I'm fascinated by that, and I really think we're sending the wrong message. So,
No, I shoot. When we were in elementary school in the 70s, even it was you'd have two recesses plus a lunch break, and it was always, what do you want to do? Let's play tackle the guy with the ball. What do you want to do? Let's play basketball. What do you want to do? Let's play soccer. What do you want to do? Let's play football. What do you want to do? Let's play tetherball. Let's play four square. Let's play. And it was always something different. If we were bored, we did something different. And we were out, at least 2 hours a day during the school day, or close to 2 hours a day during the school day, doing something. And then after school, we do more of it, And then those days have gone away. They don't want the kids roughhousing. They don't want the kids playing, and they want everything sanitized, and everything has been, kind of PE's been dumbed down, and it's going on all through North America, including Canada, U.S. It's going on, and maybe all over the world. I don't know. But it is affecting the health of our kids, and like you said, especially prepubescent. It's I think you're so right. I think your observations are quite astute.
Thank you. It's as I said, I had another article which I almost got in a bit of trouble for the title of it because I called it the overtraining myth. Mainly because not that I believe that overtraining is a myth, that it's certainly a it's a phenomenon that exists and there's a risk of overtraining, but what I called the overtraining myth was the fact that we're telling all these kids that the reason they're getting hurt or the reason the injuries are increasing is because kids are doing too much. In other words, they're overtraining. But in fact, I believe the true cause of the rise in injuries is that the kids are undertraining. They're not prepared enough for the demands of, sport and contact sport and whatever. And because they're not prepared enough, they're more likely to get hurt. There's also a really interesting book called The Sports Gene. I don't know if you ever heard of this one or.
I have not.
Oh, do you mind? I want to just tell you just about it
Share,
briefly because
yeah.
so that's they talked about some researchers in Denmark that had been doing a lot of work into looking at like the physiology of different athletes, and what they found in soccer players was so there are type 1 muscle fibers and type 2. Type 1 muscle fibers are more they have a higher blood flow. They're much more suited to endurance, long distance running, all of that. But
Is this like, is
they're
this the same as fast twitch and slow
yeah,
twitch
exactly.
or
Yeah. Type 1 are slow twitch. Type 2, on the other hand, are fast twitch. They're more powerful, they produce more force, but they get fatigued quicker. And so anyway, what they found, and this has now been replicated in other countries, but before anyone knew anything about periodization in soccer, there were 2 or 3 practices a day. There was, they would run you into the ground and all of that. And so, well, which were the athletes that were better suited to that physiologically? It was the ones that were a little slower. So the ones that had more of the type 1 muscle fibers, they could handle the higher load, they could recover better. Someone who's really fast, with a lot of type 2 fibers, they're like a Ferrari. They can run fast, but they're kind of you have to be careful with them or they'll pull their hamstring. So in any case, we look at the game in the 80s and 90s, and it looks slower, like literally, right? They're not running as fast. And if you saw, Maradona or whatever, he was so special because he was faster and everyone else seemed to be moving at like half speed other than him. Eventually, now the game has become faster, and it's not just from our observation that they've measured it. They're finding faster sprinting speeds, more sprinting in the games. All the GPS data is showing that. The theory, and these Danish guys were the first ones to look into it, was once coaches started to learn more about periodization, they started to back away a little bit from the over, the high volumes of training, the type of training that used to weed out the fast players. And now, because of better training, better sports science, well, now all these fast players that used to not be able to handle the high volume, well, now they're excelling. And so in any case, I mean, these are all variables that go into the mix. But I thought, it's an interesting anecdote because, we have to be conscious of the risk of overtraining, but we also have to be conscious of the risk of undertraining. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. So we have a system that's not going to change anytime soon. I mean, the men's game is talking about at the NCAA Division I level is in discussions about a switching to a 2 semester model or basically a 9 month season. Many of us do not think it's going to pass.
Oh, no.
Especially those older guys like me that have been around a lot of administrators, understand that administrators are going to look at this as costing more money, whether that's true or not. It's going to cost some more money. And even if it costs $10 more, administrators are going to go, no, it's going to cost us more money. We're not doing it. And we don't think it's going to pass. And the women's side apparently doesn't want it to pass by and large, players and coaches. So we're going to assume that that's going to be the constant. And even if it does pass, by the way, it's only 300 and whatever it is, 368, whatever, men's schools. That's it.
Schools,
The other
yeah.
1,000 men's schools won't change. So
Right.
for the majority of players in the United States, knowing that it's only going to be this 10 to 12 week season, and that's all it's going to be, and knowing also that the youth system is always going to have these, oh, here you go, once a month we're going to go play three games in a weekend, and it might be five, depends what type of event or tournament, and then we have this yo-yo effect that we talked about. What's your recommendation to how do we make lemonade out of lemons? We have a situation we don't like, it's a soured situation, but we have to make the best of it. What's your recommendation to players and to coaches how to manage this crazy system we've got?
Well, ironically enough, you might even be able to at least help a little bit with technology. In the sense that whether the wearable devices or anything like to me it comes down to training load because okay as you said there are certain issues with the competition structure and they're not going to change okay so fine so that's how it is and that does increase your risk of injury it does but so the question almost becomes well how best to prepare for that. That's what the
Right.
question becomes. How best to
Right.
prepare for this competition structure, which is not ideal. To me, it comes down to training load, I think wearable technology, can help track it, and I think coaches, to the extent that they can, should probably be encouraging their players. Certainly at the youth level, if you're in any of these clubs that are training like 3 days a week or whatever, nobody involved, the parents, the players, like nobody involved should ever look at that schedule and say, well, okay, that's all they need. Three practices a week and a game on Saturday. And no. They need a lot more individual training with the ball. They need to be doing running on their own. That I would encourage players to be doing, if nothing else, join the track or the cross country team at your school. Because that training alone will build an aerobic capacity that'll help them to handle the load of the sport, soccer. And I also, to the extent that you can, I think martial arts or gymnastics, some other form of, because from those sports, you get the things that you don't really get in soccer. You get flexibility, you get body weight strength training, you learn how to fall, how to roll. And I think like a real push among the coaches and even among the parents, like to tell them, hey, like put your kids in these programs, like encourage them to join the school sports teams. They need more exercise and they need a overall a higher training load progressively, but they need to build their capacity. And then at the same time, I like the idea of wearable technology. I can give a plug for it's an American company, but I work with them as a consultant. It's called Beyond Pulse, and they make a heart rate and an accelerometer. But there's other ones that do, and these
Sure.
products. Do you know about them, Beyond Pulse?
Yeah, I've seen. Yeah, I do.
Just it's a that like that's something that. If you can measure heart rate and you can measure the accelerometer is like GPS, it tells you how much running and then you can in fact you can start to look at the load and you can start to say, well, yeah, you don't want a yo-yo, but you do want the week to look like a bit of a wave. Meaning if there's a day where the load was high, well then the next day, it should go down a little. And then you don't do another high load day for another, and that, and in fact, that goes back to periodization. That you manage, the wave throughout the week, and then next week the wave looks the same, but it's a little higher. And
Right.
it's the only solution. Build capacity, and yeah, I guess if you're in a position to advocate to change the competition structure, you can do that. I mean, But it may
Yeah,
never
no, we
change.
look,
So
we can argue for it all we want, but the fact is, on the youth level, it's not changing soon. And at the college level, I don't believe we're going to see this mass change. Look, from a soccer coach's perspective, yes, I want it to change purely from a soccer perspective and from a health of the student athlete perspective and from the student perspective when I'm thinking about what's right for these kids as a student, not having to be out of class quite as often. It would be better to have a 9-month model, but it's just, I just know administrators, man, and I don't think they're going to approve it. And so that's what I want players and coaches to think about is, okay, within the current system, how do we best manage these loads, as you said, and how can we affect positive health of our athletes, right? Within an impossible task of the system that we're dealing with.
And I know you mentioned the health of the students, and it's an interesting point. In my business, in my career, I've lost track of the number of athletes that like I've worked with as they're getting ready, they're graduating high school, and usually there's a lot of them want to play in college or university, but then there are some that kind of, they don't. And sometimes even when I talk to their parents, the parents will say, well, I want him to focus on school. I want him to I want to make that the priority, or and often when I hear that, my first response is, well, then he should try to get onto his team, his college or university team, if school is a priority. The only reason I say that is because I think the extra benefit from the exercise and the the when you're on a team, there's a certain amount of discipline and time management that's involved. Again, of course, you have to stay in shape. I mean, you can't party or go to all the excesses that other college students get. You don't get down that rabbit hole of spending all your time on your phone and all that. And so I think there's, like the and there's lots of research to show that student athletes tend to perform better in school than those
They
that are
do.
not
Then the
playing
general
sports. And
student, there's actually a higher GPA for student athletes across the board than the general student has. It's true.
So I, like there's so much benefit from it, again, outside of even the soccer, from, physical health, mental health, academic performance, all of it. So I'm a big advocate for it. And It's an interesting point you made, because I'd read a bunch of stuff. Probably, I think I even saw some of your tweets before about the proposed changes to the college system. And but yeah,
Right.
if you think it's not going to happen, I trust your experience. And
Yeah, it's just my guess. I mean, we'll find out. We're gonna interestingly enough, Richard, we're the one that will pass, I think, is a mirroring of the Canadian model of giving the players 5 years to play instead of 4, which I always thought that's so smart of Canada. I think what happens here in the United States is we are so anxious to get these kids to graduate in 4 years that they have to take crazy loads, certain semesters, academic loads, where they're taking, 5 classes in a semester. And if we were to allow them 5 years to graduate, they could, certain semesters during sports, during soccer, they could take 3, right? Or they could take 4. They could back it off a little bit. It wouldn't, in certain areas of study, there's internships, and they could really lighten their load during those internships. And they wouldn't have to make sure that they graduated in 4 quite as easily, and they would be able to relax a little bit and do better academically and also be able to play their sports. So I quite like the 5-year model that I've always liked it that Canada had. And so I'm excited that I think this one will pass. We'll
That's
find out
great.
in a
And
few weeks.
I want to call attention to the fact that you use the word load describing academic load. And in
Yeah.
fact, I would argue that you can apply the same concept that I talked about, the acute to chronic load ratio. which we apply to sports and sports science, and you can apply that to the kind of the academic load or the cognitive load, like what you described with pushing students in. You know, they got to get done in 4 years, and we all know that the first year is not as hard. Like it, you know, it gets much more challenging in the last couple of
Right.
years and all of it, right? So it's like, now if they have to do five courses in one semester, isn't that a violation of the acute to chronic load ratio? Like
Sure it
five
is.
very difficult courses that are all, you know,
And we wonder why our
yeah,
kids are breaking down mentally.
burning out. Yeah. So I would argue that it's the same concept that you can apply. It's not that like studying that much is necessarily bad, but you need to build up to it. And spreading that load out into over a longer period of time means that the increases are not as much, and it's much more sustainable. And yeah, I mean, I played 5 years of university soccer as an example, and in fact, I did mainly for that reason, because I, you know, didn't want to overload myself with the schoolwork. So yeah, I live that. So yeah.
Yeah, so I that's the one that I think will pass. And like I said, we'll find out about that one in just a few weeks' time. And then I think there's a good chance that that could trickle down to the other levels of soccer, Division Two and Division Three. And
Yeah.
that's the difference between us and Canada. Like you said, Canada doesn't have, what do you have, 36 schools in
Yeah, I you
Canada
know what,
universities?
I always knew it was more than 30. So yeah, I
So
think it may be
something like
35 or
that. It
36.
might be 33. But yeah, and that actually have soccer, it's something like 30 or so, compared to America with 1,600 on the women's side and 1,300 plus on the men's side. Again, give or take numbers, there's a big difference. But I do think that that was one thing that I always noticed that Canada did that I liked, was that 5 years eligibility.
For sure.
Well,
Yeah.
anything else that you want to leave us with? What's your what are you have any projects going on that you'd like to talk
Yeah.
about?
Sure. Yeah. Maybe I guess I can speak a bit about the research that I'm doing. It may be interesting, and certainly, I mean, I'm quite excited about it. So I had it was a kind of a continuation of my PhD. I had been doing some work looking into quantifying the physical demands of the Canadian Premier League. It's our highest league, and you know, no one else had done that before. So often, you know, if we wanted to in Canada to prepare players to play pro, we would look at, well, what's the standard in Europe, and you know, a little bit, what's the standard in MLS or whatever. So I've had a paper published earlier this year, which was the first one ever to quantify, you know, how much running they do in the Canadian League, what are the physical fitness characteristics of the players in that league. And I have another longer project in the works with some more data from that league. And the next step for me, and again, this is partially because I have seen the gap, and I've lived through it as a coach and fitness coach and all that. It's not just that we don't know enough about what the demands are of the pro level here in Canada. We don't know enough about what the physical fitness characteristics, the physical demands are at the youth level. And
Right.
then on top of that, there's another thing, which is another, it's a kind of an interest and passion of mine it just gets completely ignored in Canada, is there is a concept of developmental age, meaning if you're looking at kids, teenagers, whatever, they are not all developmentally the same age, even though they are chronologically in the same age
Right.
or the same birth year. And
Right.
it's more than just, you know, if I'm born in January or February and you're born in November, you know, I'm 10 months older than you. That's called the relative age effect. But even if you took a group of boys that are 13, you know, they're all born in the same year, and there's some differences based on the month of the year. Often, and I've done this at a small level, but I want to do this now at a large level in Canada, and I've got now ethics approval from this university to do it. We're
Okay.
gonna, you will often find in teams of youth athletes, the range in developmental age can be over 3 years, meaning they're all 13. But some of them, because they're really early developers, they're
Right.
developmentally ahead, they may be, you know, 15 developmentally, and the late developers are, you know, 12 or whatever, and they're all together. And
Fit
then,
physically and emotionally?
Well, yeah, the thing is that technically speaking, an early developer usually is not just ahead, quote unquote, physically, like taller, stronger muscles, more testosterone, whatever. Cognitive development also tends to be accelerated. Now,
Okay.
it's relative to their genes and, their parents and their
Sure.
environment, and there's other things that factor in. But the basic idea is that, imagine that you're a scout for youth national team, pro academy, whatever it is. If you don't know the developmental age of the athletes that you're looking at and you're making comparisons, even if you're making comparisons physically, right? Like this guy's faster or he's better jumper or whatever, you need to
Right.
compare these players in a more fair and equitable way. And the only way to do
Right.
that is to factor in the developmental age. So
Right.
I'm, and this is another project that I'm working on with a couple of undergrad students from my school, which is we're basically just testing large amounts of players physically, like tests of speed and power and endurance and all that, but also we're measuring their developmental age, and then we're categorizing these players based on not just how old they are, but how old they are chronologically, and then their developmental age relative to how old they are. So as a
I
simple
really
example,
like this.
you like
This is really
that,
good because look what I noticed, one of the biggest mistakes that we have within our system is that we look at a player's age and we say then they must play with this age group, when what we can do for that player individually quite often is to push them up to the next age group if they're cognitively and physically ready and more mature. We should be encouraging them to play out of that age group, to go up, and sometimes 2 years up, or like you said, could be 3 years up. It's whatever that individual, but coaches and leagues will not allow that because that player helps their team win.
Win.
So that's what they care about is if, well, if we lost that player, we would win less games, instead of thinking what's right for this player. I think
Exactly.
studies like this, let's hope in the long run, could help leagues and coaches and teams understand that we are harming those players by not allowing them to move up.
Yeah, and at the same token, some that are late developers, there's nothing wrong with them,
Or allowing them to stay
moving
down.
down.
Right.
Rather
Right.
than cutting them out of the system too. It's something I've been working on a long time, thinking about a long time, and that's another project that I have going on. So
How long of a project do you anticipate this being before you get some definitive results?
Well, actually, there's a literature review that I'm looking to try to get published this year, but that's a review
Okay.
of what exists. And then that's going to hopefully set up, the data collection. It's going to be a couple of years because
Okay.
we're trying to test players, but also kind of track them, because an early developer now is eventually, their rate of growth is going to slow. They're not going to be an early developer 2 years from now. So it's there's a lot of little
Right.
things that you have to consider in order to give the best representation of the truth, let's say.
Yeah, well, I like this. So we're going to have you back on as you get start getting some results from the study, and we I would love to hear what conclusions that you come up with. That
I'd love
this
to.
sounds fascinating.
I'd love to.
All right. Well, how do people get a hold of you? If people have questions for you or they want to get a hold of you, what's the best way for people to do that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess I mean I can give my website. My company is called Speed Training, and we're here in our facility. If you hear the treadmills running in the background, that's what you hear. So speedtraining.ca is the website, and my email is richard@speedtraining.ca, and I have Instagram, speedtraining.ca. Twitter is at Rich Bucciarelli. That's my last name, so that's not easy to spell, but R-I-C-H. And then last name is BUCCIARELLI. So that, and I keep calling it Twitter, but it's X now. Yeah. So that's,
That's okay. Most of us do back and forth. Yeah, but it's hard to get in there. But yeah, no, that's great. And that's why I follow you. For those that want to follow along, you post some good content, very realistic content. And like I say, I love that it's from a soccer perspective, not just a training only perspective. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure, Don. And I'll say I know I followed you probably even before you followed me, and I think, I mean, you've got excellent content too, and especially the perspective for the college side, because I always kind of not laugh exactly, but I think like most of the players that want to go pro aren't going to,
No, that's so
but a lot of
true.
them, yeah, but a lot of them are probably good enough to play in college or university, and so that's the most likely outcome, and I think it's probably the best outcome to shoot for, and you provide a lot of really quality information to players and parents and coaches about that environment, and a lot of people are not well informed. So
Well,
yeah,
thank you.
I
I
think it's really
appreciate it.
awesome.
And I just look, we just look at this thing holistically. It's as you said, not that long ago here, we were just talking about just developing as a human being, and the physical, our bodies are meant to move, our bodies need to move, and it's going to affect our longevity and our lives. And we want these kids to develop good habits of respecting their bodies. And I think soccer's as good of a sport as any for development for these kids. And I think it goes beyond, am I going to play pro or am I going to play in college? I want it to affect the rest of their lives and what they pass on to their kids.
Absolutely. I think soccer is the best for that. So
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining. I really appreciate it, and I definitely want to have you back on.
for sure. You're very welcome. I would love to be back. So
All right. Thanks, Rich.